This is extract on a remarkable near-death experience of American neurosurgeon Ivan Alexander's own near-death, or remarkable and long-going out-of-the-body experience. Here is shrinked MP3 files as audiobook. Ivan Alexander III is born December 11, 1953. He is an American neurosurgeon and the author of the best-selling book Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, in which he describes his 2008 near-death experience, and asserts that science can and will determine that heaven really does exist.
I'm a neurosurgeon. I graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1976 with a major in chemistry and earned my MD at Duke University Medical School in 1980. During my 11 years of medical school and residency training at Duke, as well as Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard, I focused on neuroendocrinology, the study of the interactions between the nervous system and the endocrine system, the series of glands that release the hormones that direct most of your body's activities. I also spent two of those 11 years investigating how blood vessels in one area of the brain react pathologically when there is bleeding into it from an aneurysm, a syndrome known as cerebral vasospasm. After completing a fellowship in cerebrovascular neurosurgery in Newcastle upon Tyne in the United Kingdom, I spent 15 years on the faculty of Harvard Medical School as an associate professor of surgery with a specialization in neurosurgery. During those years, I operated on countless patients, many of them with severe, life-threatening brain conditions. Most of my research work involved the development of advanced technical procedures like stereotactic radiosurgery, a technique that allows surgeons to precisely guide beams of radiation to specific targets deep in the brain without affecting adjacent areas. I also helped develop magnetic resonance image-guided neurosurgical procedures instrumental in repairing hard-to-treat brain conditions like tumors and vascular disorders. During those years, I also authored or co-authored more than 150 chapters and papers for peer-reviewed medical journals and presented my findings at more than 200 medical conferences around the world. In short, I devoted myself to science, using the tools of modern medicine to help and to heal people, and to learn more about the workings of the human body and brain was my life's calling. I felt immeasurably lucky to have found it. More important, I had a beautiful wife and two lovely children, and while I was in many ways married to my work, I did not neglect my family, which I considered the other great blessing in my life. On many counts, I was a very lucky man, and I knew it. On November 10, 2008, however, at age 54, my luck seemed to run out. I was struck by a rare illness and thrown into a coma for 7 days. During that time, my entire neocortex, the outer surface of the brain, the part that makes us human, was shut down, inoperative, in essence, absent. When your brain is absent, you are absent too. As a neurosurgeon, I'd heard many stories over the years of people who had strange experiences, usually after suffering cardiac arrest, stories of traveling to mysterious, wonderful landscapes, of talking to dead relatives, even of meeting God himself. Wonderful stuff, no question. But all of it, in my opinion, was pure fantasy. What caused the otherworldly types of experiences that such people so often report? I didn't claim to know, but I did know that they were brain-based. All of consciousness is. If you don't have a working brain, you can't be conscious. This is because the brain is the machine that produces consciousness in the first place. When the machine breaks down, consciousness stops. As vastly complicated and mysterious as the actual mechanics of brain processes are, in essence, the matter is as simple as that. Pull the plug, and the TV goes dead. The show is over, no matter how much you might have been enjoying it. Or so I would have told you before my own brain crashed. During my coma, my brain wasn't working improperly. It wasn't working at all. I now believe that this might have been what was responsible for the depth and intensity of the near-death experience, or NDE, that I myself underwent during it. Many of the NDEs reported happen when a person's heart has shut down for a while. In those cases, the neocortex is temporarily inactivated, but generally not too damaged, provided that the flow of oxygenated blood is restored through cardiopulmonary resuscitation or reactivation of cardiac function within 4 minutes or so. But in my case, the neocortex was out of the picture. I was encountering the reality of a world of consciousness that existed completely free of the limitations of my physical brain. Mine was in some ways a perfect storm of near-death experiences. As a practicing neurosurgeon with decades of research and hands-on work in the operating room behind me, I was in a better-than-average position to judge not only the reality, but also the implications of what happened to me. Those implications are tremendous beyond description. My experience showed me that the death of the body and the brain are not the end of consciousness, that human experience continues beyond the grave. More important, it continues under the gaze of a God who loves and cares about each one of us and about where the universe itself and all the beings within it are ultimately going. The place I went was real. Real in a way that makes the life we're living here and now completely dreamlike by comparison. This doesn't mean I don't value the life I'm living now, however. In fact, I value it more than I ever did before. I do so because I now see it in its true context. This life isn't meaningless, but we can't see that fact from here, at least most of the time. What happened to me while I was in that coma is hands down the most important story I will ever tell. But it's a tricky story to tell because it is so foreign to ordinary understanding. I can't simply shout it out from the rooftops. At the same time, my conclusions are based on a medical analysis of my experience and on my familiarity with the most advanced concepts in brain science and consciousness studies. Once I realized the truth behind my journey, I knew I had to tell it. Doing so properly has become the chief task of my life. That's not to say I've abandoned my medical work and my life as a neurosurgeon. But now that I've been privileged to understand that our life does not end with the death of the body or the brain, I see it as my duty, my calling, to tell people about what I saw beyond the body and beyond this earth. I'm especially eager to tell my story to the people who might have heard stories similar to mine before and wanted to believe them, but had not been able to fully do so. It is to these people, more than any other, that I direct this book and the message within it. What I have to tell you is as important as anything anyone will ever tell you, and it's true. Chapter 1. The Pain. Lynchburg, Virginia, November 10, 2008. My eyes popped open. In the darkness of our bedroom, I focused on the red glow of the bedside clock, 4:30 a.m., an hour before I'd usually wake up for the 70-minute drive from our house in Lynchburg, Virginia, to the Focused Ultrasound Surgery Foundation in Charlottesville, where I worked. My wife, Holly, was still sleeping soundly beside me. After spending almost 20 years in academic neurosurgery in the greater Boston area, I'd moved with Holly and the rest of our family to the Highlands of Virginia 2 years earlier, in 2006. Holly and I met in October 1977, 2 years after both of us had left college. Holly was working toward her master's in fine arts, and I was in medical school. She'd been on a couple of dates with my college roommate, Vic. One day, he brought her by to meet me, probably to show her off. As they were leaving, I told Holly to come back any time, adding that she shouldn't feel obliged to bring Vic. For a moment, I just lay there, vaguely trying to zero in on what had awakened me. The previous day, a Sunday, had been sunny, clear, and just a little crisp, classic late autumn Virginia weather. Holly, Bond, who was 10 years old at the time, and I had gone to a barbecue at the home of a neighbor. In the evening, we had spoken by phone to our son, Evan IV, who was then 20, who was a junior at the University of Delaware. The only hitch in the day had been the mild respiratory virus that Holly, Bond, and I were all still dragging around from the previous week. My back had started aching just before bedtime, so I'd taken a quick bath, which seemed to drive the pain into submission. I wondered if I had awakened so early this morning because the virus was still lurking in my body. I shifted slightly in bed and a wave of pain shot down my spine, far more intense than the night before. Clearly, the flu virus was still hanging on and then some. The more I awoke, the worse the pain became. Since I wasn't able to fall back to sleep and had an hour to spend before my workday started, I decided on another warm bath. I sat up in bed, swung my feet to the floor, and stood up. Instantly, the pain ratcheted up another notch, a dull, punishing throb, penetrating deeply at the base of my spine. Leaving Holly asleep, I padded gingerly down the hall to the main upstairs bathroom. I ran some water and eased myself into the tub, pretty certain that the warmth would instantly do some good. Wrong. By the time the tub was half full, I knew that I'd made a mistake. Not only was the pain getting worse, but it was also so intense now that I feared I might have to shout for Holly to help me get out of the tub. Thinking how ridiculous the situation had become, I reached up and grabbed a towel hanging from a rack directly above me. I edged the towel over to the side of the rack so that the rack would be less likely to break loose from the wall and gently pulled myself up. Another jolt of pain shot down my back, so intense that I gasped. This was definitely not the flu, but what else could it be? After struggling out of the slippery tub and into my scarlet terry cloth bathrobe, I slowly made my way back to our bedroom and flopped down on our bed. My body was already damp again from cold sweat. Holly stirred and turned over. "What's going on? What time is it?" "I don't know," I said. "My back. I'm in serious pain." Holly began rubbing my back. To my surprise, it made me feel a little better. Doctors, by and large, don't take kindly to being sick. I'm no exception. For a moment, I was convinced the pain and whatever was causing it would finally start to recede. But by 6:30 a.m., the time I usually left for work, I was still in agony and virtually paralyzed. Vaughn came into our bedroom at 7:30, curious as to why I was still at home. "What's going on?" "Your father doesn't feel well, honey," Holly said. I was still lying on the bed with my head propped up on a pillow. Vaughn came over, reached out, and began to massage my temples gently. His touch sent what felt like a lightning bolt through my head, the worst pain yet. I screamed. Surprised by my reaction, Vaughn jumped back. "It's okay," Holly said to Vaughn, clearly thinking otherwise. "It's nothing you did. Dan has a horrible headache." Then I heard her say, more to herself than to me, "I wonder if I should call an ambulance." If there's one thing doctors hate, even more than being sick, it's being in the emergency room as a patient. I pictured the house filling up with EMTs, the retinue of stock questions, the ride to the hospital, the paperwork. I thought at some point I would begin to feel better and regret calling an ambulance in the first place. "No, it's okay," I said. "It's bad now, but it's bound to get better soon. You should probably help Bond get ready for school." "Evan, I really think..." "I'll be fine," I interrupted, my face still buried in the pillow. I was still paralyzed by the pain. "Seriously, do not call 911. I'm not that sick. It's just a muscle spasm in my lower back and a headache." Reluctantly, Holly took Bond downstairs and fed him some breakfast before sending him up the street to a friend's house to catch a ride to school. As Bond was going out the front door, the thought occurred to me that if this was something serious and I did end up in the hospital, I might not see him after school that afternoon. I mustered all my energy and croaked out, "Have a good day at school, Bond." By the time Holly came back upstairs to check on me, I was slipping into unconsciousness. Thinking I was napping, she left me to rest and went downstairs to call some of my colleagues, hoping to get their opinions on what might be happening. 2 hours later, feeling she'd let me rest long enough, she came back to check on me. Pushing open our bedroom door, she saw me lying in bed just as before. But looking closer, she saw that my body wasn't relaxed as it had been, but rigid as a board. She turned on the light and saw that I was jerking violently. My lower jaw was jutting forward unnaturally, and my eyes were open and rolling back in my head. "Evan, say something," Holly screamed. When I didn't respond, she called 911. It took the EMTs less than 10 minutes to arrive, and they quickly loaded me into an ambulance bound for the Lynchburg General Hospital emergency room. Had I been conscious, I could have told Holly exactly what I was undergoing there on the bed during those terrifying moments she spent waiting for the ambulance. A full grand mal seizure brought on, no doubt, by some kind of extremely severe shock to my brain. But of course, I was not able to do that. For the next 7 days, I would be present to Holly and the rest of my family in body alone. I remember nothing of this world during that week, and have had to glean from others those parts of the story that occurred during the time I was unconscious. My mind, my spirit, whatever you may choose to call the central human part of me, was gone. When the EMTs wheeled me into Major Bay 1 of the ER, I was still convulsing violently, while intermittently groaning and flailing my arms and legs. It was obvious to Dr. Potter from the way I was raving and writhing around that my brain was under heavy attack. A nurse brought over a crash cart, another drew blood, and a third replaced the first now empty intravenous bag that the EMTs had set up at our house before loading me into the ambulance. As they went to work on me, I was squirming like a 6-foot fish pulled out of the water. I spouted bursts of garbled, nonsensical sounds and animal-like cries. Just as troubling to Laura as the seizures was that I seemed to show an asymmetry in the motor control of my body. That could mean that not only was my brain under attack, but that serious and possibly irreversible brain damage was already underway. To put it simply, I had a disease that was virtually impossible for me to have. Still unable to completely accept the evidence being presented from the test results, the two doctors placed calls to experts in infectious disease at major academic medical centers. Everyone agreed that the results pointed to only one possible diagnosis. But contracting a case of severe E. coli bacterial meningitis out of thin air was not the only strange medical feat I performed that first day in the hospital. In the final moments before leaving the emergency room, and after 2 straight hours of guttural animal wails and groaning, I became quiet. Then, out of nowhere, I shouted 3 words. They were crystal clear and heard by all the doctors and nurses present, as well as by Holly, who stood a few paces away, just on the other side of the curtain. "God help me!" Everyone rushed over to the stretcher. By the time they got to me, I was completely unresponsive. I have no memory of my time in the ER, including those 3 words I shouted out, but they were the last I would speak for the next 7 days. Evan froze in the doorway when he saw me. In his 20 years, he'd never seen me with more than a cold. Now, in spite of all machines doing their best to make it seem otherwise, he was looking at what he knew was, essentially, a corpse. My physical body was there in front of him, but the dad he knew was gone. Or perhaps a better word to use is, elsewhere. Chapter 5. Underworld. Darkness. But a visible darkness, like being submerged in mud, yet also being able to see through it. Or maybe dirty jello describes it better. Transparent, but in a bleary, blurry, claustrophobic, suffocating kind of way. Consciousness, but consciousness without memory or identity. Like a dream where you know what's going on around you, but have no real idea of who or what you are. Sound, too. A deep, rhythmic pounding. Distant, yet strong. So that each pulse of it goes right through you. Like a heartbeat? A little, but darker, more mechanical. Like the sound of metal against metal. as if a giant subterranean blacksmith is pounding an anvil somewhere off in the distance, pounding it so hard that the sound vibrates through the earth or the mud or wherever it is that you are. I didn't have a body, not one that I was aware of anyway. I was simply there, in this place of pulsing, pounding darkness. At the time, I might have called it primordial, but at the time it was going on, I didn't know this word. In fact, I didn't know any words at all. The words used here registered much later, when back in the world, I was writing down my recollections. Language, emotion, logic, these were all gone, as if I had regressed back to some state of being from the very beginnings of life, as far back, perhaps, as the primitive bacteria that, unbeknownst to me, had taken over my brain and shut it down. How long did I reside in this world? I have no idea. When you go to a place where there's no sense of time as we experience it in the ordinary world, accurately describing the way it feels is next to impossible. When it was happening, when I was there, I felt like I, whatever I was, had always been there and would always continue to be. Nor initially, at least, did I mind this. Why would I, after all, since this state of being was the only one I'd ever known? Having no memory of anything better, I was not particularly bothered by where I was. I do recall conceptualizing that I might or might not survive, but my indifference as to whether I did or not only gave me a greater feeling of invulnerability. I was clueless as to the rules that governed this world I was in, but I was in no hurry to learn them. After all, why bother? I can't say exactly when it happened, but at a certain point I became aware of some objects around me. They were a little like roots, and a little like blood vessels in a vast, muddy womb. Glowing a dark, dirty red, they reached down from some place far above to some other place equally far below. In retrospect, looking at them was like being a mole or an earthworm, buried deep in the ground, yet somehow able to see the tangled matrices of roots and trees surrounding it. That's why, thinking back to this place later, I came to call it the realm of the earthworm's eye view. For a long time, I suspected it might have been some kind of memory of what my brain felt like during the period when the bacteria were originally overrunning it. But the more I thought about this explanation, and again, this was all much, much later, the less sense it made. Because, hard as this is to picture if you haven't been to this place yourself, my consciousness wasn't foggy or distorted when I was there. It was just limited. I wasn't human while I was in this place. I wasn't even animal. I was something before and below all that. I was simply a lone point of awareness in a timeless red-brown sea. The longer I stayed in this place, the less comfortable I became. At first, I was so deeply immersed in it that there was no difference between me and the half-creepy, half-familiar element that surrounded me. But gradually, this sense of deep, timeless, and boundaryless immersion gave way to something else. A feeling like I wasn't really part of this subterranean world at all, but trapped in it. Grotesque animal faces bubbled out of the muck, groaned or screeched, and then were gone again. I heard an occasional dull roar. Sometimes these roars changed to dim, rhythmic chants, chants that were both terrifying and weirdly familiar, as if at some point I'd known and uttered them all myself. As I had no memory of prior existence, my time in this realm stretched way, way out. Months? Years? Eternity? Regardless of the answer, I eventually got to a point where the creepy, crawly feeling totally outweighed the homey, familiar feeling. The more I began to feel like a me, like something separate from the cold and wet and dark around me, the more the faces that bubbled up out of the darkness became ugly and threatening. The rhythmic pounding off in the distance sharpened and intensified as well, became the workbeat for some army of troll-like underground laborers, performing some endless, brutally monotonous task. The movement around me became less visual and more tactile, as if reptilian, worm-like creatures were crowding past, occasionally rubbing up against me with their smooth or spiky skins. Then I became aware of a smell, a little like feces, a little like blood, a little like vomit. A biological smell, in other words, but a biological death, not a biological life. As my awareness sharpened more and more, I edged ever closer to panic. Whoever or whatever I was, I did not belong here. I needed to get out. But where would I go? Even as I asked that question, something new emerged from the darkness above. Something that wasn't cold or dead or dark, but the exact opposite of all those things. If I tried for the rest of my life, I would never be able to do justice to this entity that now approached me, to come anywhere close to describing how beautiful it was. But I'm going to try. Chapter 7. The Spinning Melody in the Gateway. Something had appeared in the darkness. Turning slowly, it radiated fine filaments of white gold light. And as it did so, the darkness around me began to splinter and break apart. Then I heard a new sound, a living sound, like the richest, most complex, most beautiful piece of music you've ever heard. Growing in volume as a pure white light descended, it obliterated the monotonous mechanical pounding that, seemingly for eons, had been my only company up until then. The light got closer and closer, spinning around and around and generating those filaments of pure white light that I now saw were tinged here and there with hints of gold. Then, at the very center of the light, something else appeared. I focused my awareness hard, trying to figure out what it was. An opening. I was no longer looking at the slowly spinning light at all, but through it. The moment I understood this, I began to move up, fast. There was a whooshing sound, and in a flash I went through the opening and found myself in a completely new world. The strangest, most beautiful world I'd ever seen. Brilliant, vibrant, ecstatic, stunning. I could heap on one adjective after another to describe what this world looked and felt like, but they'd all fall short. I felt like I was being born. Not reborn or born again. Just born. Below me there was countryside. It was green, lush, and earth-like. It was earth, but at the same time it wasn't. It was like when your parents take you back to a place where you spent some years as a very young child. You don't know the place, or at least you think you don't. But as you look around, something pulls at you, and you realize that a part of yourself, a part way deep down, does remember the place after all, and is rejoicing at being back there again. I was flying, passing over trees and fields, streams and waterfalls, and here and there, people. There were children, too, laughing and playing. The people sang and danced around in circles, and sometimes I'd see a dog running and jumping among them, as full of joy as the people were. They wore simple yet beautiful clothes, and it seemed to me that the colors of these clothes had the same kind of living warmth as the trees and the flowers that bloomed and blossomed in the countryside around them. A beautiful, incredible dream world. Except it wasn't a dream. Though I didn't know where I was or even what I was absolutely sure of one thing. This place I'd suddenly found myself in was completely real. The word real expresses something abstract, and it's frustratingly ineffective at conveying what I'm trying to describe. Imagine being a kid and going to a movie on a summer day. Maybe the movie was good, and you were entertained as you sat through it, but then the show ended, and you filed out of the theater and back into the deep, vibrant, welcoming warmth of the summer afternoon. And as the air and the sunlight hit you, you wondered why on earth you'd wasted this gorgeous day sitting in a dark theater. Multiply that feeling 1,000 times over, and you still won't be anywhere close to what it felt like where I was. I don't know how long, exactly, I flew along. Time in this place was different from the simple, linear time we experience on Earth, and is as hopelessly difficult to describe as every other aspect of it. But at some point, I realized that I wasn't alone up there. Someone was next to me, a beautiful girl with high cheekbones and deep blue eyes. She was wearing the same kind of peasant-like clothes that the people in the village down below wore. Golden brown tresses framed her lovely face. We were riding along together on an intricately patterned surface, alive with indescribable and vivid colors, the wing of a butterfly. In fact, millions of butterflies were all around us, vast fluttering waves of them, dipping down into the greenery and coming back up around us again. It wasn't any single discrete butterfly that appeared, but all of them together, as if they were a river of life and color moving through the air. We flew in lazy loop formations past blossoming flowers and buds on trees that opened as we flew near. The girl's outfit was simple, but its colors, powder blue, indigo, and pastel orange peach, had the same overwhelming, super vivid aliveness that everything else in the surroundings had. She looked at me with a look that, if you saw it for a few moments, would make your whole life up to that point worth living, no matter what had happened in it so far. It was not a romantic look. It was not a look of friendship. It was a look that was somehow beyond all these, beyond all the different types of love we have down here on Earth. It was something higher, holding all those other kinds of love within itself, while at the same time being more genuine and pure than all of them. Without using any words, she spoke to me. The message went through me like a wind, and I instantly understood that it was true. I knew so in the same way that I knew that the world around us was real, was not some fantasy passing and insubstantial. The message had three parts, and if I had to translate them into earthly language, I'd say they ran something like this. You are loved and cherished, dearly, forever. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. The message flooded me with a vast and crazy sensation of relief. It was like being handed the rules to a game I'd been playing all my life without ever fully understanding it. We will show you many things here, the girl said, again, without actually using these words, but by driving their conceptual essence directly into me. But eventually, you will go back. To this, I have only one question. Back where? Remember who's talking to you right now. I'm not a salt-headed sentimentalist. I know what death looks like. I know what it feels like to have a living person whom you spoke to and joked with in better days become a lifeless object on an operating table after you've struggled for hours to keep the machine of their body working. I know what suffering looks like and the answerless grief on the faces of loved ones who have lost someone they never dreamed they could lose. I know my biology, and while I'm not a physicist, I'm no slouch at that either. I know the difference between fantasy and reality, and I know that the experience I'm struggling to give you the vaguest, most completely unsatisfactory picture of was the single most real experience of my life. In fact, the only competition for it in the reality department was what came next.